Welcome to the second hour of A Voice of a People. My name is Linda Sims. This is WGH Talk. We also stream live on the web, www.wwgh1071.com. You have the opportunity to download a free app. You can find this app in your Play Store on any electronic device, iPhones, cell phones, laptops, or computers. And once you type in Tune In, search WWGH. You'll always have the talk radio show on your phones, okay? Or your electronic devices. I would love to share with you those who faithfully support A Voice of a People, starting with Chappie's Hydraulic Hose Specialist, LLC, 1325 North Main Street here in Marion, Ohio. Phone 740-382-8552. We have Logos Christian Ministries, Pastor Jackie Peterson at 582 Lee Street, Marion, Ohio, 740-223-1515 or www.logoschristianministries.com. Ongoing announcement for them, free produce every third Saturday of every month. This will take place September the 21st, 12 noon until 2 p.m. Please note your calendars. Please call others that you may know of that need free produce and take advantage of this yourselves. Last but not least, Inspect Ohio LLC, your one-call home inspection company with 30 years of experience working for you. Owner Cheryl Lee, location LaRue, Ohio. Phone 740-262-0939. And I have a thought for you today. I shared this last hour, and I will be sharing this hour. I assume and like to hope that we have new listeners out there for this second hour, and maybe some of you have stayed over from the first hour. And this thought is titled, Vision of Success. Having true faith in our goals and confidence in ourselves determines our destiny. There is no room for doubt. Just as in nature, when the root is deep, there is limitless strength. With every thought, we can reaffirm our goals, creating a vision of success. So let us reaffirm our goals so that we can each create a vision of success. And I was sharing yesterday, use positive words and forget the negative. Okay, all things are possible with Christ Jesus. Now I will turn my attention over to my guest today, Fred Malone. I'm having a beautiful time with him today. Our first meeting and first show here on A Voice of a People. And it will not be his last, okay? So he is from Marion's Historical Society. And let him introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Linda. I want to mention a couple of things that I'm going to be involved in coming up pretty soon. Do you remember when Ohio State did the LEI classes, Learning Education for Adults? The library, right before COVID started, the library basically picked up that same idea.
Okay.
And they of course, weren't able to do much during COVID, but they picked that up again for the fall, and I'm going to be involved in a couple of those classes coming up in October. The first one is October the 3rd at 10 in the morning, and it's going to be at the library. Now, there is a small charge for these. If you go on the library's website, you can get all the information about the
right
charges and that type of thing. And I don't remember what they're calling the program. I know it's like the LEI class, only it's, it may have another name. But my first class will be on October the 3rd, 10 o'clock, at the library, back in their meeting room. I will be portraying this gentleman that I'm going to be portraying during the dinner for the president's.
Colonel
Edmund Starling, right? Secret Service agent to five U.S. presidents, from Woodrow Wilson to Franklin Roosevelt. He actually came to the White House on Christmas Eve of 1914 to take his position with President Wilson, and stayed there until Thanksgiving Day of 1945.
Wow.
When he retired after 30 years of service, and that was during Franklin Roosevelt's administration. I'll be doing an hour-long program I'll try to keep it an hour. I get kind of windy sometimes. If I'm on a roll, I might run a little bit longer than that. But the program is supposed to be for an hour. And I'll be talking about basically, I'll give a little history of talk a little bit about my character. And I'll be in first person, so don't try to ask me who I am. But I'll talk about my life and how I got to the White House, and then I'll tell a few interesting stories about each one of those five presidents that I served when I was working in the White House, and they will be stories that you wouldn't ordinarily be taught in school or you wouldn't ordinarily read anywhere else.
Okay.
So they'll be kind of firsthand type stories. This gentleman that I'm portraying, Edmund Starling, as I said, he retired in 45. In 1947, he released a book that he wrote, co-wrote with the help. He wasn't a writer, obviously. He was a Secret Service agent, but he had a ghostwriter help him, and he wrote a very interesting book about his life. And so that's where I've taken most of my information. So it's all firsthand stuff.
Right.
No, it didn't come from a biographer. It came directly from him. So that is October the 3rd. And if you're interested, I think you just go to the library's website and you can get tickets there or stop at the library. On October the 10th, same program type thing, but this time it'll be at 10 o'clock out at Lynn School, which is on Route 4. And this will be Jan Augenstein and myself, and we'll be portraying school teachers from the one-room schoolhouse, and we'll be talking about what it was like to attend a one-room schoolhouse back in the early 20th century, you know, right around 1880, 1890 to 1910, somewhere in that neighborhood. And, of course, we'll be appropriately dressed in the dress of the time. And I have to check with the library to see if they've told, if they've put a number on that, because we can only hold so many people in Lynn School. If you've been out to Lynn School before, it only accommodates
Cyrus, right?
Yeah, on Route 4 North, it only holds about 40 people. And you have to remember that the desks that are in Lynn School that you're going to sit in were designed for kids. So we do have a couple of benches at the back of the room. Excuse me, but I would imagine that class size is going to be limited, and there probably will be a class size on the one at the library too, but check with the library on those if you're interested. And as I say, I know there's a small charge. I think they base it on you can take one, two, or all the classes. I think you get a little break if you sign up for all of them, but you can just pick and choose the ones that you want and pay an individual charge for those.
Okay.
And I don't think it's all that much. But again, that's coming up on October the 3rd at 10 and October the 10th at 10. Most of the people that have listened to me over the years know that I'm involved in several other historical groups around the area. Since I lived and worked in Sycamore for about 25 years, I was a founding member of the Mohawk Historical Society, and we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary coming up here before too long. But I always like to mention a couple of things about Mohawk Historical Society. We are now open for the summer on Saturdays only. Again, this is staffed by volunteers from the area. But we just recently built an additional building attached to our other two buildings for our museum, which when you stop to think about it, for a town of 900 people, to have a three-building museum is pretty unusual.
Yeah.
Now, the Mohawk Historical Society is comprised of the Mohawk School District. That's where we get our name. And the Mohawk School District actually takes in three parts of three different counties, Wyandotte County, Crawford County, and Seneca County. It's a pretty good-sized school district. So there was a lot of history in that in those three county areas. Now, most of the history is coming from fairly small communities, Sycamore probably being one of the largest communities in that three-school district area.
Okay.
So that's where we get most of our information from. But the Mohawk Historical Society puts out a really great newsletter. And if you're a member of the Historical Society, it only costs you $10 a year. You get six newsletters, and they are absolutely fantastic and well worth the $10. I'm not just trying to get you to join because I want your $10.
Right.
It's just a really good organization. And we, the newsletter itself, Most of the information in there is gleaned from old newspapers from the area, going back as early as 1800. Mm. And a lot of times there are snippets in there from the Marion area as well, because we do pull parts of our information out of Marion County because it's contiguous with the Wyandotte County.
Right.
So we've got a lot of members that belong just to get the newsletter. And some of them are from the Marion area. But the newsletter, as I said, is part of your membership. It's only $10. Once you join the Historical Society and attain the age of 80 years old, you no longer pay dues, but you still get the newsletter.
80 years old.
Yeah, we've grandfathered anybody in that once they turn 80, they don't pay a membership again, but they continue to get the newsletter. So it's a win-win situation for everybody. Currently, the museum is open, as I said, on Saturdays from 1 to 4, or by appointment. And you can check, they have a website, Mohawk Historical Society, and there's a Facebook page as well. But if you just type in Mohawk Historical Society, Sycamore, Ohio, you'll see what's all is available that you can get on and check those things out.
Okay.
We also, a number of years ago, we purchased the old Eden Township Hall, which is in Melmore, just up the road, and that's in Seneca County. And that was originally built as an opera house. And we bought that from the Eden Township trustees about 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, when they decided to build a new building. And they offered it to us at a very reasonable price. Since then, we have completely redone the place. We've got heating and air conditioning in it now. The original stage is still there. The original backdrop is still there that was painted. And we do a lot of concerts there.
Right.
A lot of groups and so forth that come in. We just had a gentleman in the name of Bill Foley, who is actually a Columbus native. But he's worked with people like Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Leslie Gore, The Grassroots, Jefferson Starship, Jerry Seinfeld, James Taylor. He's done backup music for them and also opened for their different acts.
Right.
And he did a one-man show for us just recently. That's kind of things we get up there. And these are all free. You don't even have to be a member of the Mohawk Historical Society to attend those. Just check out our website and our Facebook page and find out when the next event is. And you can go for free.
Right, okay.
Can't beat it.
As long as you live to be 80 years old, right?
Absolutely. Well, and even now, you don't even have to be 80 years old to go to a concert up there. And it doesn't
That's
cost
true.
You a thing. Yeah,
That's
it's
so
all
true.
Free. It's all
so
free.
True.
Just recently, actually, on Sunday, the 21st of August, we celebrated the 200th anniversary of the first Methodist church service in Sycamore.
Mm.
And I portrayed Reverend James Finley, who was the gentleman that actually gave the first church service in Sycamore 200 years ago.
How was that?
It was very interesting. We had a really nice crowd there. We had a social that day at the church. They're actually in the second building of the church. The first church service was actually held in a person's home in Sycamore, because they didn't have a church then, and so they held services in different people's homes.
Okay.
And so this was one of the very first settlers in the area that the service was held, and the Reverend John Stewart, have you ever heard that name?
Yes, I have.
From Upper Sandusky, he and Reverend Finley both attended and provided the service, and they were very good friends at the time. Of course, Reverend Stewart is a black man.
Okay.
Reverend Finley is a white man.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very good friends in the early 1800s.
Good.
And so they shared that service together, and I had a great time that day portraying Reverend Finley. He was a very interesting gentleman. He was a circuit riding minister who traveled from Cincinnati all the way to the mouth of the Maumee River, which is all the way up near Lake Erie, on horseback.
Ooh.
And yeah, he started in the very early 1800s, and I think he died in 1857 or something like that. But over the years, he kept diaries, and he wrote. He had enough in his diaries to write five different books over those years.
Okay.
And most of these books were published in the 1840s to 1850. He was also the chaplain for the Ohio Penitentiary for a couple of years. And one of the books is called Life in Prison, which he talks about his life as a chaplain in the penitentiary. And times were tough back in those days. Prisoners in the penitentiary did not have a good life. And he did what he could to bring Christ into their life because they had nothing else. So very interesting man. And I am so fortunate over the last, I'm a book person, and over the last several years, I've been able to attain all five original copies of those books that were published in the 1840s and 1850s.
Wow.
They're fascinating reading. One of them is Life with the Indians, where he talks about ministering and bringing Christ and Christianity to the Indians, especially the Wyandotte Indians in the upper Sandusky and the Wyandotte area.
So was that a large population for Ohio to have Native Americans?
Oh, yes, it was. In fact, they were, at one time, they were probably one of the largest groups of Native Americans in Ohio, were the Wyandottes. Of course, we had the Senecas, the Hurons. There were several other groups of Indians scattered throughout the Northwest Territory or the Ohio Territory. But yes, the Wyandottes were probably very. And interestingly enough, the Wyandotte Nation, which I think is out in Minnesota now. I think that's where they're relocated to when they did the Trail of Tears years ago. But I think they're in Minnesota now. But anyway, they keep in close touch with the Wyandotte Mission in Upper Sandusky, and actually they make a pilgrimage back every year. And the chief of the nation is a very good friend of Ronnie Garvin, who is the curator for the museum up in Upper Sandusky. And like I said, they come back every year. And our president of our society in Sycamore has had many discussions with the chief.
Okay.
Yeah, so in fact, he's been in Sycamore a couple of times too. So, but a very, very interesting group to belong to. And again, for $10, you get such a great newsletter and all those concerts. Can't beat it.
Do they still wear their feathers and things like that?
For ceremonial things, for ceremonial things. It's just funny. The president of our group, when I was up there doing this church service a few weeks ago, interestingly enough, the service that I did, I used Findlay's words.
Okay.
From some of his writings, I took out of his books and used some of his words that he delivered. Part of one was a sermon he gave to a group of Native Americans at the Wyandotte Mission. So it was kind of interesting too to find that out. But interestingly enough, when the chief was back a couple of years ago, the gentleman, our president of our group up there, asked him, he said, "Well, do you ever think about building a casino in Upper Sandusky?" And the chief said, "I've got 12 in Minnesota, and that's enough to worry about." 12 casinos.
That's
but I guess
lot.
It's a moneymaker for them, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the Mohawk Historical Society. I'm also on the Board of Trustees for the Malabar Farm Foundation, which is over in Richland County, and that's the home of Louis Brumfield, which most people have listened to me before have heard me talk about. Mr. Brumfield was a born and raised in Mansfield, became a ambulance driver during World War I for the American Ambulance Service, and after the war, came back to New York and spent some time in New York writing reviews for plays, all the time wanting to be a writer. And when he came back to Ohio, or while he was in New York, he met and married his wife. Then they, by that time, he had written his first book, which was a bestseller, and actually at one time won the Pulitzer Prize for literature. They then went to France, lived a number of years in France. They had three children, three daughters. When the World War II looked like it was on the verge of breaking out in Europe, which would have been in 1938-39 when Hitler came to power, decided he better move the family back to the States because he was very controversial, definitely against the Nazi regime.
Yeah.
And he was afraid it might bring problems to the family. So they moved back to the States, and he bought two farms in Richland County because his grandfather had grown up on a farm and he'd worked on the farm when he was a kid. But this time he had written several books. It was very popular. And built this beautiful, rambling 32-room home on these farms, which you can tour today, which is still there, and has all of its original furnishings in it. Built this house over a period of 2 years to make it look like it had been added on to over a period of 10 years. Great architecture. But anyway, lived there until 1957 when he died. He wrote 31 books in 30 years. At the height of his popularity in the 30s and 40s, he was the highest paid author in the world.
Okay.
More so even than Hemingway and people like that. Friends with Hemingway, friends with people like Edna Ferber, all the very popular authors of the day was very popular and friends with. But the farm today belongs to the state. When he died in 1957, he had made it known in one of his books, Pleasant Valley, that he had hoped that on his passing that the property would eventually belong to the people of the state of Ohio so that everyone could enjoy it. So in 1957, when he passed away, the Friends of the Land, which eventually became the Malabar Farm Foundation, owned the property for a number of years. And in 1972, according to Louis' wishes, they donated it to the state of Ohio for $1. Hmm. And so in 1976, it was opened as a state park. And it's been a state park ever since. There's roughly 1,000 acres on the park right now.
That's big, isn't
which
it?
Encompasses, yes, it's the only state park in the state of Ohio that has a working farm on it. And we still raise beef cattle there. We have pigs, we have hogs, we have chickens, we have donkeys, we have horses. And the whole idea of this is to get people that live in urban cities and urban surroundings to be able to come to this state park and see what farm life is really like.
Okay.
And as I said, the house you can tour, it's a 32-room house with all the furnishings from 1940. He had three daughters. The daughters all went their separate ways. They certainly believed in what was done with giving the property to the state of Ohio. They clear up until the last one's death 4 years ago. They were very supportive of the organization and came back periodically to visit. So it's a great place. But you can tour the house. You can take a tour of the farm. You can walk the trails. There's trails you can go through the woods. Plenty of things there for you to do. There's a visitor center there. There's a lot of things for the kids to do. There's a playground there. Obviously, you can have a picnic there. You can spend the day there. Just an absolutely great place. I did want to read a little bit about the farm that happened back in June of this year. In the late evening hours of June the 13th, a severe storm with tornado-level winds ripped through Malabar Farm, through the woodlands, tearing hundreds of trees completely out by their roots and shredding many others that remained standing. The worst damage occurred along the bridle trail, which is a horse trail, and in the sugar maple stand east of the Pugh Cabin, where nearly half of the maple trees were lost. I need to mention that every year in February, March, we make maple syrup over there. We'll tap anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 maple trees.
That sounds good.
We may not be able to do that many this year, depending on how many are left standing after that storm. But we try to produce all the maple syrup for the state parks in Ohio. Fortunately, no buildings were damaged. Power to the park was lost for nearly a week, closing the gift shop and halting all tours. But with the restoration of electricity, the gift shop reopened and tours of the big house and the farm have resumed. So you can still take those. And that's like a nominal fee. I think for like $6 you can tour both the house and the farm tour, which is on a wagon. The Jungle Brook Trail was temporarily closed. However, it's open again. The Butternut Trail and the Dorstrug Trail are also open. Some trails, unfortunately, still remain closed and will probably be closed, I would say, the balance of this year because there's a lot of cleanup work, a lot of trees to be moved off the trails and cleaned up. And some that didn't completely fall will have to be felled so that we don't have any problem with people going through there, horses going through there. But if you have any information, you can call the park, 419-892-2784, or you can go on the website. We actually have our own website. The foundation does. It's Malabar Farm Foundation. And then also, if you go on the state, just under state parks, you can find Malabar Farm by going to that website. But ours is the malabarfarm.org is our website. Our Facebook is www.fb.com/malabarfarm. www.fb.com/malabarfarm. Or just look up Malabar Farm and you'll find all of it.
Right, right.
So that's the news I have on Malabar Farm. One other thing I wanted to mention before we talk a little bit about history, and I know I'm not leaving a lot of time for history today, but I haven't been here for a couple of months, so
that's true.
I'm trying to play catch up today, if you don't mind.
That's true. I don't mind. Go ahead.
The Marion County Historical Society is in the midst of a capital campaign, and I mention this because we are in dire need of repair on our roof.
Okay.
As you can imagine, the building that housed the original post office, well, not the original post office, but one of the post offices that was built in 1910, still has the original roof on it. It's original tile roof, which we do not want to take off, and we aren't going to take off. But to repair that roof... And we're getting some leaks in the museum now. But to repair that roof, we're looking at a couple $100,000 just to repair the roof and to keep the same tile that are there. There are companies that still recreate that tile and remanufacture that tile. But as you can believe, it's very expensive. I know... In the last 10 years, they redid the Catholic Church roof up in Cary, which has the same kind of tile roof on it. And that to redo that roof on that church was $1 million project.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So now it was in a lot worse condition than this one. But still, a couple $100,000 for an organization that gets no state or federal money, that's a big expense.
It is. Very big.
In addition to that, we have 9 heat pumps that service our building, plus a boiler. And all of those heat pumps are well beyond their 20-year lifespan. Some of them are into the mid-30s in their lifespan. And we continually are servicing and repairing those old heat pumps. They need replaced. And that project is probably going to be at least another... $275,000 to $300,000 to restore those, to replace those. Those are anywhere from $25,000 to $35,000 each.
Okay.
So that's an expensive project in itself. The building itself needs repointed. It's a partially brick and partially sandstone. Big block. If you've driven past it before, you know what the building looks like. So our goal is to raise $1 million.
Right.
We were just fortunate enough recently to be granted $200,000 from the state of Ohio from their budget this year.
That was nice.
And we were also fortunate enough to get a grant of $230,000 from the county commissioners as part of the American Build Back program that President Obama started when he was in office. So, and with some private donations and some corporate donations to this point, we are about 62% to 64% of our goal, but we still need more money. The interior and the exterior of the building, not counting the roof and the HVAC system, will eat up the other 38% of what we need to get us to our $1 million. So we're still about $375,000 short of what we need. So we need individual and corporate help along that line as much as you can do. Some of the work that's involved just with the roof is remove the tile and the underlayment, new self-adhering underlayment, replace the tile and patches required, tear off the remaining build-up membrane roof. There's a membrane around the exterior of it that's rubber. That'll need to be replaced. Repair and repoint the stone head joints. Clean the drains. We're going to take the skylight out. If you remember, there was a skylight in the original building. That's been the service of a lot of problems over the years because skylights leak over time.
Yes, they do.
It was great when it was put in, and probably the first 50 years it was good. The last 50, not so much. So that needs to be demolished and infilled. and then cleaning out that interior skylight. And then what we thought we would do is add an artificial skylight.
Okay.
So that the appearance of the skylight is still there, but the leaking the leaking is gone. So again, that's just a portion of that particular campaign. HVAC related, we've got to remove the old systems, replace with a new efficient system. There's going to have to be some reworking of duct work where it needs, and also electrical. So that's about the other part of that. And then outside, we're going to have to repair all interior plaster. The walls all need repainted. They haven't been painted for a long time. Some of our flooring, which has been painted in the past, needs to be repainted. The electrical system needs to be updated. It hasn't been done since they put the addition on in the 60s. Mm. That's the back part of the building. So that's another portion of it.
That's another 60 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So altogether, it's going to add up to roughly $1 million. And again, is our goal trying to get to that $1 million figure. So as I say, we're about 38% short of our campaign. I like to tell people this is a marathon, not a 5K. So we're not asking for all this money overnight.
Right.
People can pledge over a five-year period. Mm-hmm. You know, if they wanted to give $100 for 5 years, every little bit helps. I say there's no amount too small, there's no amount too big.
Right.
You know, so if someone says, gee, I would love to help, but I only got $50, that's great.
Right.
You'll go down as a contributor, and it will every little bit helps. It's just like your own house.
That's true.
You know, you've got constant repairs and constant things to keep updated, and this building is absolutely no different. Absolutely no different. So, again, that capital campaign is ongoing. It started at the beginning of the year, I guess, the public part of it. We've actually been working on this now for about the last 2 years, trying to get all of our ducks in a row and get ready for it. But as you can imagine, it's a big undertaking when you're a small organization with a very small budget. Our annual budget to operate the Historical Society is around $140,000, which sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at the fact that we're trying to upkeep a building that's 118 years old, 122 years old.
That's what I'm looking at.
Now, and we do have two full-time staff and a part-time staff member. Our executive director is full-time, and our administrative assistant is full-time. Our educational director is part-time, and we have a lot of volunteer help. Mm-hmm. So we do have some salaries to pay, but believe me, they could go in the private sector and make a whole lot of more money than they could working for a 501c3. And that's the other thing. We are a 501c3 nonprofit.
Okay.
So anything that you donate can be taken off your income taxes.
Right.
It is a credit. Right. But we're operating primarily with a pretty small budget for what we have to do. Now, we include, I like to tell people, if you come to the Marion County Historical Society's Museum, now you get five museums in one building. You get the Marion County Historical Society, you get the Wyandotte Popcorn Museum, which is the largest popcorn museum in the world.
Really?
We get people from all over the world that come here just to see the popcorn museum. Then they're astounded to see that there's other things to look at in
there. Right.
Beside that. Now, as of the first of the year, we have the Mary Ellen Withrow Museum mm-hmm. in our facility. We have the Buckeye Telephone Museum
right.
in our facility. And we have the Woodland Elves Museum in our facility.
Okay. Sherry Williams,
right. So you get five museums for the price of admission. And I might be wrong, but I think the admission is $6 for adults, $5 for seniors, and $4 for kids. And if you're under a certain age, you get in for free.
Right, right.
And when you leave, you get a box of popcorn. You can't beat it.
That's for sure.
And you can spend... I just gave a private tour to one of the members, one of the board members of the Crawford County Historical Society. Gave a private tour to them a couple weeks ago, he and his wife. And we were in there 3 hours. Mm. And they said, we got to come back.
Right.
We got to come back because you can't really see and read everything
too much
that is in there.
See.
Right. Right.
At once. Yeah.
And recently, and you may be involved or know about this, recently, within the last few years, we've been trying to involve more of the Black history in Marion County and in Marion itself. So, and that's become a great part of the museum itself. Yes. There's so much history. There's so much history, period.
Yes, it is.
In this county. And we like, you know, I think sometimes people think, oh, yeah, it's just the Marion history. No, it takes in the entire county, every little township, every small community, every faction of life in Marion County.
Right. I have a few things in the African-American part, too.
Yeah,
yeah,
well,
family,
and,
yeah.
That, and that's been a great addition.
Yes.
It absolutely has been a great addition. But any support that we can get from the public, we certainly do appreciate. We certainly do encourage. And again, if it weren't for the fact that we have a group of volunteers and we have a great membership that supports us, and I have to thank the Marion County Commissioners because with the exception of a couple of lean years, they have been financially supportive of us as well, making us a part of their budget, and we've come to really appreciate the people that serve in the capacity of commissioners here in Marion County. I think we've had a great board over the years, and I hope that continues. But to get that $230,000 was a big boost to this capital campaign, I can tell you.
Okay.
A very big boost. But if you're interested in contributing, you can do so by just dropping a check off at the museum or put it in the mail or go on to our website, marionhistory.com, find out more information. And like I said, no dollar amount's too small. We welcome anything. We're desperate. We're desperate. We want to keep that museum open,
of course,
for
yes.
the future because, you know, if we don't know anything about our past, we don't know where we're going in the future.
That's so true.
You really have
to.
So
true.
And the key now is to get more young people involved in Marion's history and in the museum. And we've done that to a certain extent with some of the programs that we do with our interaction with the schools and with our summer programs and with our night at the Heritage Hall. We've brought kids in to portray children characters from the years, which is a big help. Florence Harding was big with Newsboys, so we've incorporated Newsboys and Newsgirls into our program, so that when we do Night at Heritage Hall, they can run around selling newspapers, you know, make believe type of thing, and the kids love it.
They really get
into it. So that's a great part of it.
It sounds like you know a lot of cool things, you know, for kids and adults.
Well, yeah, and again, like I said, it's so much easier to learn history if someone portrays it
to you in first person, acts it out,
right. It's like sitting down and watching television.
Yes.
But we're going to teach you something, you know. It's not just something to dull the mind, you
know. Right.
We're going to teach you something. Well, I do want to tell a couple of stories here. And again, I've over the years, I have collected my thing is history. I don't read fiction. I'm not one of those people that like novels. I like history.
Okay.
So I read a lot of history and I acquire a lot of books. In fact, my wife says I have way too many books. I have stacks. You know, libraries have stacks. Why can't I?
You
know. But in the last year or so, I found this book called Best Little Stories from the White House. And I've read through it a couple of times, and I've recreated some of these stories in programs that I give. But I always run across a story that I think people may not know about. And so today I want to talk about Drama Behind the Desk.
Okay.
And this is from 1880. The connection between a British rescue ship once trapped and abandoned in the icy Arctic fastness of the 19th century and handsomely carved Resolute Desk. Have you ever heard of the Resolute Desk?
Maybe.
That's in the Oval Office?
Maybe.
Used in the Oval Office by so many 20th and 21st century American presidents. This story goes back to 1852. The year that Great Britain sent out a squadron of rescue ships to find a missing Arctic explorer by the name of Sir John Franklin. He had sailed from his homeland 7 years earlier in search of the Northwest Passage through the Canadian Arctic waters. Now, there were a lot of people trying to find that Northwest Passage to the sea, to the Pacific Ocean. All too soon, after splitting up into two elements, one to the east and one to the west, Most of the rescue vessels themselves were frozen in place and abandoned, and one of them was called the HMS Resolute. Their crews were rescued, and some of the ships were later recovered. Their captains, nonetheless, were court-martialed back home in England because they abandoned their vessels, but they were eventually acquitted. Meanwhile, the empty Resolute, a prisoner of the pack ice, slowly was carried eastward. In September of 1855, 3 years after the ship was abandoned, 1,200 miles away, it was found. American whaler George Henry discovered her adrift in the ice off of Cape Wilchingham in the Davis Strait. Crewmen from the whaler then sailed the Royal Navy ship back to their home port in New London, Connecticut. They arrived on Christmas Eve of 1855. Now, the ship was missing for 3 years, brought home 3 years later on Christmas Eve. All this came in a time when relationships between Britain and the United States were so strained that President Franklin Pierce had sent the British ambassador home for violating the Neutrality Act by recruiting immigrants to fight for Britain in its Crimean War against Russia. Soon after, though, Virginia's U.S. Senator James Murray, grandson of a founding father, quickly got approval of a bill for the purchase of the purchase of the ship for $40,000 in reimbursement to the British government for all as a goodwill gesture. Accordingly, the good deed was done, and the HMS Resolute cruised on for the Royal Navy for another 2 decades before its retirement and final trip in 1879 to a scrapyard. After that, it apparently was a complete surprise when a large wooden crate arrived one day in 1880 at Rutherford B. Hayes White House. Prying open the crate, workmen found it contained a strikingly handsome carved oak desk. A plaque on the front of the desk explained that it was built from the timbers of the broken-up Resolute and was now a gift from Queen Victoria to the President of the United States and the people of the country, in response to the courtesy and loving kindness that prompted the return of the ship back to Britain in 1856. Now, various presidents have used the desk at various White House locations over the years, most notably since after Jackie Kennedy saw it and placed it in the President Oval Office for her husband John F. Kennedy. It became instantly famous when the publication of a heart-tugging photograph of their then little boy JFK Jr. peered out from the world from the keyhole in the desk. Remember the photograph?
Yes, I do remember that.
That same keyhole actually was given our mate handsomely carved modesty panel by the polio-crippled Franklin Roosevelt to hide the braces on his legs, but he died before the movable panel could be finished. Harry Truman kept it in place in memory of his predecessor, FDR. On the hinged panel is a presidential seal, but with the eagle's head turned toward the arrows to its left talon, contrary to the official presidential seal showing an eagle which had turned toward the peaceful olive branch in his right talon. After JFK's assassination in 1963, the desk was loaned to the Kennedy Library for a traveling exhibition and then was put on display at the Smithsonian Institute. It was Jimmy Carter who brought it back for use in the Oval Office. It then served as official centerpiece in the presidential office for Reagan, Clinton, George Bush, and Barack Obama. During recent years also, LBJ found it too small for his large frame, and a brand new desk was built for him by the Senate Cabinet Shop. Richard Nixon and Gerry Ford preferred another desk associated with vice presidential urge, and George H.W. Bush still another desk that he had used as twice president under Reagan. And I think our current president has now brought the Resolute desk back.
Okay, all right.
The story of the desk.
So Lyndon Baines Johnson, he was a large man?
He was a large man, yes. He was, I think he was 6'7 or 6'8.
He was?
Yeah, and he had broad shoulders and a very big frame, yes. Right. With the exception of William Howard Taft, he was probably our biggest president. Now, William Howard Taft was not extremely tall. Mm-hmm. He was wide.
Okay.
He weighed in excess of 350 pounds when he was president.
Mm.
In fact, interesting story connected with William Howard Taft. It was true that he did become stuck in the White House bathtub.
He did.
And they had to build a new bathtub big enough to fit his girth. Yes.
It's not funny, but oh yeah. My. Yeah. I didn't realize
that. Yeah, I did want to mention to you real quick, okay, I can't be here for the October show. I'll be on a trip.
Okay.
But I'll be back in November.
Get in touch with me, and we'll go ahead and book you in advance.
Definitely.
Thank you, Fred Malone, for the second hour. Well, both hours, I feel richer. I've learned so much history from him today, and I'm sure you have enjoyed him today as well. So thank you for listening to A Voice of a People here on WGH Talk. If it was your first time, don't let it be your last time. So thank you so very much. Till next time, be blessed. Thank you so much. Bye.
You're listening to WWGH Radio, LPFM, Marion, Ohio, the place for...